From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
The area around Philadelphia is well known for its richness of public gardens, including many historic ones, but the region is also home to an impressive roster of distinctive private landscapes, from formal 19th century European-style estates to mid-century modern residences and contemporary ones. Now a new book takes us inside the gates of 21 of them, places filled with ideas for our own gardens, maybe too. So more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Walcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Private Gardens of Philadelphia is the new book from garden writer Nicole Jude and photographer Rob Cardillo. Both of them are Pennsylvania gardeners in their own right. Its pages welcome us into a rich world of horticulture and landscape architecture, and I'm so glad they're here today to tell us about some of what they saw and learned in creating the beautiful book. So welcome. Nice to have both of you. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us to be with you.
Thank you, Margaret.
Happy yes. Evening. And so I'll say before we get started that we'll do a book giveaway with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. And I've been enjoying looking at, oh boy, there's just so much beauty and so much to learn, you know, from reading and looking at the book. So just to get started, you know, I mean, I keep wondering why this area around Philadelphia, because I mean, not long ago, I read a book about the DuPont family gardens in the Brandywine Valley in that same area, and now here's your book. And what are the forces that you guys think made this area so horticulturally rich? I know in the book you say something like, it's the northernmost southern city and the southernmost northern city. That's made me laugh, and I wonder if I was going to be able to get that out without getting it wrong.
Well, you know, this is a question that I have been pondering over for many years because I'm not from Philadelphia. And when I got here, I was astonished by the number of public gardens. And then as I became more involved in gardening, private gardens. And this book was the excuse or opportunity to do a really deep dive into trying to unpack a little bit of or some of the factors anyway, that all kind of conspired to make gardening such, expressed really almost at like its highest form in Philadelphia. And not to say that there are not amazing gardens elsewhere, because there certainly are in many areas, but there really is a concentration here. And there is a culture of horticulture that is quite strong here. We have a lot of horticultural institutions. We have, you know, college degree programs focused on horticulture as well as certificate programs. But I got really interested in some of the historical factors that led Philadelphia to have such a concentration of gardens. And one of those that might be interesting to your audience is that, you know, Philadelphia, which is not a particularly prosperous city today, was incredibly wealthy right during that golden age of horticulture, when you think of like the robber barons and the big industrialists. And there was so much money to be made in Pennsylvania, basically by exploiting its natural resources in the late 19th and early 20th century. Incredible deposits of coal through most of Pennsylvania, wood that could be made into charcoal, which then could be made into iron and then steel, and then those used for the tracks for these railways. There were a lot of great railway fortunes. And this was all happening at the same time that having a fabulous garden, even if you didn't particularly care about gardens, was just something that wasn't really even socially desirable, but it was almost like a prerequisite.
Right, right. Well, and I think that the European tradition, and of course, many of the people who came, you know, and settled, you know, obviously European origin and so forth. So that was a tradition that was almost imported in a sense. Yeah. Yeah. Rob, did you grow up there? Are you from?
Oh, no, I'm a transplant also from Pittsburgh. And there was almost no real horticulture, at least when I was growing up. So when I came to Philadelphia, I was just overwhelmed by the number of public gardens and arboreta. And then, you know, eventually started finding the private gardens, which are just, there's some amazing gardens. And I had thought for years that a book about these private gardens would be wonderful. I had done a book on private gardens of South Florida a few years back with Jack Staub, and I found it to be really, you know, it was wonderful, but I kept thinking, why isn't there a similar book to on Philadelphia? I mean, we have our gardens seem to be a little bit more reality based than Florida, and sort of more conscious of conservation and more attached to history. And so the idea for this book was actually a few years in the making.
Yeah. So the book, of course, you know, shows and tells the stories of these gardens and their makers, and in some cases their history, depending on whether they're some of the older gardens. But, you know, in the photos and the words, I found a lot of ideas of kind of lessons, as I said in the introduction, for gardens and gardeners elsewhere as well. And I thought maybe we could highlight some of those. And it was interesting because, you know, some of them were just little ideas that just reminded me of something that I was like, oh yeah, I want to do more of that. You know, like for instance, there was, and the, I think the gardens, you tell the name of the town that each one is in, you know, in the sort of headline. And I think one is in Coatesville. Is that how you say the place? There was like these beautiful pollarded willows, you know, in Coatesville, and even the old stump of a willow resprouting, and, you know, just these very simple things that anyone could do, but it just had been done and had been maintained for years, and it was just wonderful. And I just thought, you know, why don't we all do more of that? You know, that's not expensive and it's not complicated and it just requires consistency. So which one of you wants to start and tell me something that you saw that sort of stuck with you or that you think other people would benefit from?
Do you want to go first, Rob, or shall I?
You take it, Nicole.
There were a number of things that I feel like I took away from the project, and some that have really kind of changed my own gardening, and a really easy one that I have paid so much more attention to since studying these gardens is that I now have an arborist come up to my garden in the winter and do structural pruning on younger trees, deciduous trees, like a cornice moss, a cornelian dogwood, crepe myrtles, like anything that just benefits from being shaped while it's young. It's not expensive, and then it just pays off for the lifespan of that plant. And one thing that was very consistent among these gardens that were wildly different in size and style and cultivation was people had invested early in getting their woody plants shaped beautifully.
Yes.
That's kind of a really probably the most obvious one. I thought there were a lot of really interesting lessons in how people use objects in their garden. There are some gardens in the book that really have very little in the way of ornament, and that anything that's not living would be something utilitarian, like a wooden tutor to grow roses up, or just a simple picket fence. And then there were other gardens that made lavish use of found objects as decorative elements and sculptures. And, you know, some of these were, you know, important sculptures, and some of it was people finding things that they liked, like an old piece of, you know, industrial equipment and putting it in their garden, or making something themselves out of some, you know, inexpensive materials. So it kind of gave me a broader sense of how ornament can be used in gardens and objects. And and the same with kind of positive and negative space too.
I'm sorry. So you,
the same with positive and negative
space. Oh, yeah. As another idea.
Yeah. There are not very many gardens that have a lot of open space between plants in the book. And I thought that was kind of interesting, and how people kind of played off the void, you know, of a lawn or a gravel garden with then something really lavish in terms of a planting plan. So.
Yeah. And I think a lot of times we think we have to plant up everything, and you're right. The opposite, having the antithesis of it, you know, makes the lushness over there seem more exciting in a way. So,
yes, Rob, what about you? Better than me.
Well, no, but Rob, what about you? Were there things that really, and you know, you come at it with a different eye, not just as a gardener, but as a photographer, and you've photographed, oh my goodness, I can't even imagine how many incredible gardens over the years. And what struck you in particular?
Well, that's interesting. And what struck me, it's actually, I'll piggyback a little bit on what Nicole said, was that, you know, the use of ornaments and objects can add a lot of personality to a garden. They become very important focal points, especially, you know, when you're dealing with naturalistic plantings. It seems like it calls out for something to just hold the eye a little longer. And even expanding on that a bit, I know one of the gardens, there's one in Frenchtown, where the woman who is, I think she's a trial lawyer now, but she used to be an interior decorator, decided to paint her outbuildings certain colors that would match the flowering trees. There was like a, you know, her barn is painted partly red, like a red aesculus that blooms nearby, or there's a soft white she uses behind some of her hydrangeas. And, you know, there's a nice gray that complements her flowering wisteria. And I just realized, you know, how a lot of people don't really consider that when they're painting outdoors, that, you know, that you can actually pick up the colors from the garden and put them on the walls.
Huh. Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting you say that, because one of the gardens that struck me, and I don't know for you two what you thought, and I don't know how to say the place, Rydal, R-Y-D-A-L. Is that how you say it? How do you say the town?
Rydal, yes.
Rydal. There was a mid-century modern house, and you point out, Nicole, in the book, you point out that, you know, we know what a Victorian garden is supposed to look like, and we might know, you know, what certain other period gardens are supposed to look, colonial garden, but we don't know what a mid-century modern garden is supposed to look like. And those people, kind of like what you were just saying, Rob, they picked up on the some of the color things. It's sort of these panels of color on the side of the house, and then they planted certain of the annual things and other things in the beds that picked up on those colors, like blue and red, I think, were two of the colors. They'd have big swaths of blue and red in the beds as well as on the side of the house. And they used that Corten steel, those beds. I'm always so envious of those. Those kind of, it looks like rusty metal, but it's this incredibly strong steel that can be bent and made into, it's sort of like amoebic shaped, all these interesting shaped, kind of mod looking beds. Again, that picked up on the style. I kind of love that. Do you guys, do you know the place, of course, and you probably could describe it better.
No. That's Craig Wakefield, and he's a mid-century fanatic. I think he redid the house first, and maybe Nicole can expand on that. But his entire house was redone to reflect or to restore it back to a mid-century look, and then he decided to make the gardens, in that fashion. Which, you're right, there is no tradition of mid-century gardening. So it was wonderful to see. I think it was very innovative and clever.
Yeah. Yeah. And then were great, yeah, too.
He was inspiring to me because, right, he had been so fastidious in restoring the house to exactly how it would have looked when it was built in the late 40s. And then with the garden, he just let himself go completely free and just have the garden that he wanted. And what I love about that garden, among many things, is that strong use of color. And, you know, a modern architecture is not supposed to be very graceful or welcoming. That's not the point of it. And then, but he's put in this garden, and especially his use of ornamental grasses that have such incredible movement constantly, and then this very static, rigid structure behind it. The way that the landscape and the architecture play off each other is fantastic.
Yeah. And then again, those steel beds, but so they're very solid, but they're, again, the sort of the shapes are a little soft, I think, at some of the edges. And mm-hmm. so it's like this hard, soft thing, you know, it was fun. It was really fun to see the experiment that was going on there. But I do love to pick up on Rob's point that the idea that we can think about color and color either being inspired by the color of our house and then using that in the garden or vice versa, and that that's a way to anchor things better. So, Nicole, do you have another sort of aha? Was there something else that really stuck out?
Well, people had done some pretty creative and really attractive, taken measures to manage stormwater, which becoming a bigger and bigger issue. I didn't quite realize that throughout our region in Philadelphia, in some places, it's really not very, there aren't a lot of restrictions around what you can and can't do. But yet other areas that have a more delicate watershed, it is extremely restrictive of how much you can, how much you can build, how much open space you need to leave, what kind of mitigation measures you need to put into place. And so people had done really interesting things from very complex rain garden systems to a dry stream bed that would have the capability of channeling water when it comes through, and to planting a lot of trees in wet areas and taking, or meadow plantings, which in some cases made land that hadn't been usable in a very long time because it was too wet when it flooded into space that you could actually walk on or play on or ride your horse on. So that was interesting. And I think that there are details about the kind of like interventions that people took to deal with some of these challenges.
Right. There was one in Wayne, Pennsylvania, that had a series of rain gardens that, you know, to deal with the problem with the wet, but it didn't, you know, in the pictures, at least, congratulations to Rob, you know, it didn't look at it and go, oh, it's a bunch of rain gardens to solve the problem of wetness. It was just beautiful. You know what I mean? It was, so the sort of technology, if we want to call rain gardens technology, that strategy was used, but in a very beautiful way. So it's practical and beautiful. And I think that's what we more, as gardeners, we have to unite the two things, not just the aesthetic, but also the practical in these changing, fast changing times, in these challenging, unexpected times.
That's true. And actually, in that garden in particular, the rain gardens aren't just simply pits or depressions, but they're, you know, they're highly engineered sets of pipes underneath in certain types of soils so that everything drains out in a really smooth way. And it takes maintenance too. They need to be cleaned out, I think, every year, so that all the debris is. So it's not just a simple rain garden. It's
right.
A bit of engineering to get it to work.
There was another one that I haven't seen in many, many years. Charles Cresson, who's been gardening a long time in that area, a well-known gardener, and he manages to have so many different plants versus, you know, big drifts or multiples of a smaller palette of plants, and yet it hangs together. Can we talk about that a little bit? Because I think that's a problem. A lot of us have that collector inclination. We want to get, oh, look at that, look at that. Oh, I want to get that. I want to try this. I want to try that. And it can just get to be a mess, right? A collection and not a garden. And yet he manages it. How does that work?
Well, I feel that because that's my own personal challenge with gardening. Have you heard this phrase, drifts of one?
Yes, drifts of one, exactly.
And Charles's garden is absolutely a collector's garden. And Rob, I'll be curious what you think. I mean, one is that he does have like a true collection garden where he'll have multiples of a genus or a species and put them in some areas in proximity to one another so that it's not completely discordant or disconsonant. So the camellias are all in one area, even though it might be 50 varieties. And he collects kind of categories, so rock gardens, bonsai, and we'll kind of group them together. I think that helps. Rob, what do you think?
I think it helps too. I think it helps that he gardens probably more than anybody I know. I mean, he's out there constantly, and most every day I visit the gardens, he is there. He works really hard. He has some helpers. And I think he just is his he's on top of everything, and his eyes is good, and he can see where things aren't working, and he's not afraid to move things and shift things around. He's fanatical, and I love that in a gardener.
It helps to be fanatical. I love what you were saying, Nicole, about the, grouping the camellias, grouping the whatever. It reminds me of gardens that I really loved in visiting English gardens years and years ago. I was attracted to go see all of the famous, what they in some cases called order beds or taxonomic beds or systematic collections where related plants were put together. Usually it was by family of plants, all the Aster relatives were put together or whatever, all the grasses were put together. But I loved seeing that because it could still be beautiful. It didn't have to look purely scientific. It could still be done with beauty. And so yeah, that's a good description. Any other ones we wanna who wants to mention another aha? Or just highlight.
One that just keeps coming back to me, and perhaps, I mean, it's something probably everybody learns early on, is just it's like the beauty and futility of symmetry. Trying to make something symmetrical in your garden and having it reflected on the other side is just it, in your mind's eye, it can look really beautiful until something dies or sort of is stunted or needs to be pulled, and then you're sort of stuck. And I, you know, some of it just it's a shame when you see gardens that are just, you know, where a boxwood has succumbed to something and it's a missing tooth in the garden. So I always think that there is, I think instead of symmetry, people are moving more towards, you know, a dynamic balance, something that is that they might have some symmetry, but it's not a direct symmetry. It's not a mirrored symmetry.
It's not like a parterre, a four square formal kind of old style garden. Yeah. Huh. Okay. And Nicole, another
I'm
thought?
gonna see if I can articulate this, but probably the most to me profound thing that I still think about since finishing this book is how people can be really good at doing something, extremely talented, but then you could take it to the next level, which is to be able to articulate why it is that you are making the choices that you're making and aesthetically and with your design. And that's something that I have been bad at doing in my own practice of gardening. If you were to ask me, why do you like alpine gardens so much? I don't know. I just do. I feel like it. I enjoy them. But it turns out I like the idea of worlds within worlds in a garden. And I wouldn't have been able to articulate this if I hadn't spent so much time talking to people who were so good at framing what it was they were doing in their garden and why. And I would kind of encourage anyone who's really into gardening and also doesn't feel very articulate, like I often don't, to just practice even in your own head of putting into your impulse into an actual thought of why it is that you're doing what you're doing. Because it's a discipline, but it also is quite satisfying and fun.
That's a good point, a very good point. Uh-oh, now I'm in trouble. I kind of be sitting here thinking about that, wondering why am I doing what I'm doing over here. In the last two or three minutes we have, is there a Rob, do you have one more that you want to share, for instance?
No, I'll just pick up on Nicole's. I think I learned that too. It seems like every garden needs a mission statement. And I think I put mine together too during this book, and it's evolving, but at least I have themes now that I can work in my head. So it's a positive thing.
Does that help? Like, I mean, at this time of year, one of the big dangers, of course, is that we can all go binge and run amok when they open the garden centers and so forth. So I guess having a mission in our head would help us even with that, right? If we are shopping and moving things around within the garden and so forth, is to let that be in our mind, front of mind. Yeah.
Yep.
I think so. And in planning new projects in your garden and to think about like what it is that you want to do and what you're trying to, what's your philosophy behind that? What are you trying to accomplish? What are you trying to convey? It just makes it just adding another layer of texture and richness to a project that is already going to be very textured and rich.
So you two, you're not out running around looking at gardens together this spring, are you?
No, it's sad. We had a couple of really fun years of doing that.
I bet. Well, you certainly did a magnificent job. I mean, as I said, the book, and we're going to have a giveaway with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com, but the book is Private Gardens of Philadelphia. And it's, it's so great that you collaborated, and it's not just well researched and written, but it also has the beautiful photographs. So, I mean, you can really dig into each garden and kind of get the whole picture, which helped me a lot. And I just want to thank you for making the time today to tell us a little bit more about it. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.